Thank you for the invitation today. I will present you a paper about literature and some novels that treat this question from a literary point of view. So I've been working for on these questions for some years, and this part concerns only particularly literature for young people. So these works were realized in the research center of EDF and partly in the research centers, international research centers of CERI, Sciences Po. So even if the crisis, which began in 2008, and its effect on the economy changed our priorities and have for the time being pushed environmental issues and climate change onto the back burner, we can see that that today it is virtually impossible to avoid fictions or mainstream television programs and different forms of media coverage brought about the climate change and by climate change. Their analysis is even more interesting in as much as they are part of the long history of the social discursive imaginary concerning climate change related issues and more generally environmental risks. Indeed, climate change and catastrophes have ever been a concern. The Bible contains premonitory visions of rising sea levels, which over the very long term might be the result of a runaway greenhouse effect. Over time, there have been numerous references to the passage of comets near to the Earth, and these have often been interpreted as signs of forthcoming catastrophes and or of renewal. For a long time, comets and meteors had the function of mediator between God and humans, who then had to understand the divine message. They were signs which required interpretation and to which men gave meaning. Connections were made between the passage of a meteor and the various plagues and other calamities which took place. Not just outbreaks of the cholera and other calamities or famine, but natural catastrophes as well. Whether they were seen as punishments or warnings, the explanations given over the centuries are a mixture of religious and rational interpretations, with a ranking in the legitimation of the interpretations which changes over time. Over the centuries, the number of hypotheses put forward to explain extreme and extraordinary phenomena increased, leading to the emergence of a far broader range of ontological topics through which to understand the world. Indeed, whatever the era, man has needed to mobilize moral and cultural references alongside empirical knowledge. The different conceptions of nature, risk and catastrophe are thus cultural phenomena with variations that might have significance from one historical period to another. So I'll be looking at fiction. So in a few words, why to study fiction? Because if we look at fiction, that is an imaginary construction of the world. It allows us to refer to reality, but it is not reality. It teaches us necessary or even vital things about mankind and about how society works, while at the same time reassuring us about the imaginary nature of the narrative and the imaginary status of the referent. Fiction thus fulfills a substitutive function. It replaces things, pleasant or terrifying events that we do not necessarily have to experience ourselves in the real world. Works of fiction can also make us more lucid at a period when all too often, in my mind, discourses which are supposed to or which pretend to tell the truth are merely a patchwork of fictions reworked by storytelling specialists. Fiction engenders and generates meaning, something that is vital in a modern Western world which is structurally deprived of sense. Literature thus allows us to represent ourselves and to interpret the world in which we live. Through narrative, mankind attempts to give meaning to climate-related disasters. Literature is one of the most important vehicles through which to convey archetypal representations of catastrophe. Scientific or religious explanations are cultural resources through which to understand them. Our vision of the world is influenced by a large number of historical, social, individual, and cultural variables. The Earth's climate changes are often associated with a vision of the end of the world, of course, one of the major themes of Judeo-Christian culture. Cosmic cataclysms are often one of the recurring themes for science fiction writers and, over recent decades, for film producers. Meteors, epidemics, and other major catastrophes are laden with significance for human beings who often interpret them as manifestations of divine wrath. They believe that they have transgressed taboos, that they have gone too far. The subject is a very ancient one. There are numerous references at different periods to comets passing close to the Earth, and they have often been interpreted as in fiction as signs of something terrible about to occur, or of renewal. Some examples of Flammarion, The Last Days of the World, or The Poison Belt or by Conan Doyle, and so on. These works are part of the tradition of narratives of the end of the world, which are warnings and which, ever since the apocalypse of Jeanne, turn such ends into promises of renewal. As with the age-old tradition, the dread of apocalyptic catastrophes announces and prepares for the birth of a new creation. Nowadays, the providentialist paradigm has not disappeared, but the Promethean paradigm is considerably stronger, presenting mankind and its inventions as capable of dominating the forces of nature. Some examples that I won't present today, Armageddon, Deep Impact, and so on. So all these analyses about movies I will not present today. There is a book about that if you are interested in, or we can talk about that. So I go directly to the children's literature. So if we take the children's literature that we are studying today, the question of children's duties is gathering strength through the ever-increasing panoply of issues covered. We are finding themes for modern life, terrorism, divorce, and so on, and above all, environmental themes, especially that of the consequences of climate change, with the particular problem of making the younger generation aware of long-term global problems for which they are in no way responsible. What duty falls upon young people when facing such a challenge? How does this literature present the world we live in, and how does it see the future from the standpoint of climate change? How does it attempt to solve the delicate equation which combines the need for a behavioral shift, especially with regard to energy consumption, towards more abstemious lifestyles, making young people take more responsibility without pointing the finger, and the dominant cultural imaginary of overconsumption in which these works are received and which, despite certain societal evolutions, promotes material riches, friends, and the ownership of often energy-intensive gadgets. Can or must this literature help to give birth to a new generation with new mindsets who will become prescribers of new ways of living and of consuming in an attempt to save the world for the irresponsibility of adults? So let's try to find some answers to this question through a semiotical analysis of some works, two novels by Jean-Michel Paillet published in 2010, The Drowned City. So the title is 2065, The Drowned City, and the Water Pillagers, and two other stories of Jean-Pierre Andrévon, which were published in 2003, Marée Descendante, Falling Tide, and La Dernière Pluie, The Last Rain. So these four novels have numerous points in common, which are also found in other works which are not part of our central corpus of analysis. The federating elements are notion of rising sea levels and that of extreme weather phenomena which can be put down to climate change caused by human beings. Climate change generally tends to appear in this work of fiction in the form of meteorological phenomena which are directly related to water, never-ending rain, tsunamis, cyclones, floods, and to a lesser extent in the shape of drought or desertification. This strong convergence in themes might be interpreted as the influence of dominant Western representations of the consequences of climate change, more frequent extreme meteorological events, and rising sea levels. The acceleration of desertification in Africa and the dramatic consequences which are already perceptible are for the most part ignored, as are other geographically distant examples. Two examples of Paillet. So Jean-Michel Paillet's 2065 novels are characterized by an absolute temporal localization, because as soon as we read the title, we know that events will take place in 2065. Yet the hero, 10-year-old Emile Collot, is a contemporary of young readers in the early 2010s. The situational context of the first novel, The Drowned City, is located within the societal context of the early 21st century with all its environmental concerns. It is Emile's sister, Clémence, who tells him about these issues. The Emile of 2010 is a boy who plays on his computer and who is not particularly interested in the state of the planet, unlike his highly committed sister. His journey into the future, made possible by an invention of his grandfather, is also a quest for the truth about himself. His objective is to see whether he will really suck or, on the contrary, become someone worthwhile. To find out, he must undergo a series of tests in the far-off future in 2065. Over the 55 years which separate the two situational contexts, the change in climate has already had consequences. The weather is no longer the same as at the beginning of the century. It is far hotter. The village of Emile's grandfather where he lives has become a tourist attraction, the village of yesteryear, with air conditioning for the tourists. Emile's town has been swallowed up by the ocean, which continues to advance over the land, aided by repeated tsunamis. Emile is thus faced with the effects of global warming that his sister had endlessly gone on about and which are all around him. The boy then asks himself, could we have avoided this? I remember, he says, Clemence's tirades about greenhouse gases global warming and melting ice, which causes rising sea levels. She could really go on and on about all that, but the results are right here in front of me. The 2065 town seems to be a little bit more ecological than it was at the beginning of the century, so today. A great deal of public transport, few cars which run on recycled waste, solar panels on the roofs, narrow entrances to buildings to protect them from the heat. The narrative clearly follows a process which takes us from an initial situation to a final situation. In its final situation, the initial state has been modified in a positive sense. Emil has understood that the future is full of possibilities and that it is up to him whether he sucks or whether he becomes someone worthwhile. More generally, he realizes that we can build a different future through our everyday actions. We thus see the moral and psychological transformation of our hero, who proves to be both brave and honest. The successive events narrated by Emil are organized so as to create suspense, the quest for his own destiny within a narrative with many twists and turns, and where readers will only learn the outcome at the very end, at the same time as the hero himself. Proximity to a young readership is achieved using a familiar register of language, of lexical fields, of techniques of style, which are characteristic of the way young people speak. The humor and the play on words are ever present and help to create an endearing character with whom young readers can quite easily identify. The proximity created with the hero strengthens the reader's adherence to the values put forward in the novel, the responsibility of each and every one of us to protect our environment, and more especially to fight against climate change. Despite a journey through time, the narrative structure and the stances of the actors are relatively simple. The goodies, those who want to protect the planet, and the baddies, those who prefer to make money and pollute, are easily identified, and there is little room for nuance. The political regime and the way society is organized in the second half of the 21st century are only vaguely sketched with no real in-depth examination. Unlike what usually characterizes science fiction, where there is often a new dominant technological fantasy paradigm, there is nothing wonderful about this 2065 world. Everything seems to have been done to avoid much regression. Renewable energies and nuclear power are at the fore, with the latter providing fast and reliable public transport. As in Jules Verne's novels, the author imagines major improvements to the technology contemporary to the period of writing. For example, high-speed trains running at 500 kilometers an hour, a far more sophisticated Google, and so on. But no technological rupture is envisaged. This is representative of the modern era of our time, where there are no more utopias. Literature reflects a feeling of disillusionment in Western culture. Mankind is shown to be responsible for and even guilty of the degradation of the natural environment. The Promethean paradigm has been pushed to the limit by human beings who want to dominate everything. Not only have they depleted all of the planet's natural resources by continually wanting to consume more, they have modified the climate, which has turned against them. But the future is not carved in stone, says Jean-Michel Paillet. And in other novels, we can see that the younger generations can change the course of history. This is a little bit the theme of the second novel, The Water Pillagers. The questions that the heroes from Emil ask in these books reflect the feeling of guilt that can be experienced by the younger generations who are very much aware of the environmental dangers created by our lifestyles. For the very young in particular, but more generally for all of us, the question of guilt must be addressed. On behalf of future generations, on the basis of an ethic for the future so dear to Jonas, should we challenge current behavior relating to consumption, particularly of energy, to transport, and more generally to our ways of living? If the answer to this question is yes, we must consider the modalities of such a challenge to avoid citizens swinging the pendulum back as a result of incessant guilt-making discourses. As we have seen with the Drowned City and other movies, Waterworld and a lot of other movies, fear of rising sea levels and of land being swallowed up as a result of climate change is a recurring subject in literature and cinema. Jean-Pierre André Vaughan wrote a story for children, Marie Descendante, Falling Tide, in which climate change has led to rising ocean levels. The temporal location is once again absolute. The story begins in 2027. From the CLIMSAT space station, the pilot, astronaut Farshid, and his crew watch the end of the world as we know it today. Huge cyclones are forming, 200-meter tsunamis flooding everything, uprooting everything, trees and buildings, herds and vehicles fleeing. A megacyclone, Dragon 3, has hit Indonesia, and it's likened to a pustular mushroom and to a silent atomic explosion. The team finds itself abandoned in space. They decide to use their high-tech tomb to sleep for a century. And the only one hero that survives, Farshid, wakes up more than three centuries later in 2345. So he is the sole survivor. The Earth is once again blue, the oceans having gained a lot of ground. All major cities appear to have been abandoned. The pilot lands in flooded Picardy with an acidic iodine atmosphere. It is 36 degrees in the shade. Tropical insects surround Farshid, and he can see sharks around his solar-powered craft. After 3 days, he arrives at the flooded capital. So we learn that during the final 7 decades of the 21st century and the first quarter of the 22nd century, the Earth lost over half its population, almost 5 billion people. The huge loss was not directly due to climate disasters alone, but to the consequences, famines, wars, epidemics. No nations as we know them today were able to resist these events. According to a brief summary, the new world which has emerged would seem to bring together several ingredients required for a sort of phalanstery. All members of Federation wear the same clothes, tunics, trousers. The regulator talks about the gradual rebuilding of new territorial units, which are all based on respect for environment, respect for one another, and a political system similar to that of an ancient Greek democracy. Farshid thus becomes aware that the civilization he left behind has disappeared, probably forever. Apart from a few notes of hope for the very long term, his work offers a dysphoric vision of the future. Civilization, as we know it, is condemned to disappear. The last novel presents the same dysphoric atmosphere, so it is the last train. This novel is talking also about human responsibility without saying exactly who is responsible. It might lead to these guilt-making discourses who people reject. especially Western youngsters who, since birth, have had forced upon them that I could call forced hand of the culture, so social impositions of a consumer society. The only way of living they have ever known is that offered by a consumer society, and they have never been given any credible alternative. So when the hero of this novel, Sebastian, hears that, it is a citation, we are paying for all of mankind, for him is a stupidity. The teenager refutes this accusation because he does not feel guilty about anything. He says, a comment which doesn't get us anywhere and which almost made me angry. I don't feel guilt about any stupidity, and I don't see why I should pay for the rest of humanity. The comment, nevertheless, went round and round in my head all the day. Their habits change very fast when extreme and unusual events take place. In this novel, we can see that. Human beings are able to rapidly modify their behavior when they have to. Sebastian Fathers, an unemployed engineer, decides to build an ark. The reference to the biblical Noah's ark is clear. With a cold fusion generator to try to save his family, the fuel is water, which is highly practical given the circumstances. And to achieve this, he uses new materials which were designed for the construction of new nuclear power plants that we will never build, he rejoices. In this short story, the nuclear plant is never put forward as one of the possible solutions to climate change, but rather as a human invention which is too dangerous due to radiation and waste. The deteriorating situation and society's disorganization are demonstrated by the attack on Sebastian's house by a group of young people. They are pushed back by the teenager's mother, who shoots them at them with a rifle, and she found prior to these events. And Sebastian says, dressed all in leather with a red scarf across her shoulders, she looked like something out of Mad Max. This reference to the American trilogy about a post-cataclysmic barbarian world suggested one of the possible futures resulting from extreme climate change, a return to barbarism, to anarchy, or to a totalitarian system. Sebastian's family decides to leave. Their house is full of mold. There is water everywhere. We find further similarities with Noah's Ark when we read that they take with them some animals, cows, hens, a cock, trout, and so on, which will enable them to survive as well as seeds that they can sow in hydroponic greenhouses. They call their ark Gaia, the personification of Mother Earth in Greek cosmology. They do not know where they will go, how long the rain will continue to fall, or what life will be like after this new flood. They do not know if they will survive. There is, however, a speck of hope at the end of the story when we can see a little bit the sun. Despite this end, the short story is also characterized by an extremely pessimistic vision of the future. People must get by on their own if they wish to survive. Society is slowly disappearing and is no longer able to protect individuals. In a world of scarcity and shortage, it is the survival of the fittest, and everyone else is the enemy. It is a return to barbarity. So in children's literature, we find the predominance of dystopia, which makes it similar to adult fiction, also dysphoric. Children's books only scratch the surface of the complex issue of climate change. It is its consequences which attract the greatest attention, along with the question of how human beings adapt to the new environmental conditions. Narrative construction is far more orientated towards capturing attention and emotional involvement than towards over-detailed explanations of the causes. The narratives focus on a main character, which is often a child, to enable identification. The narrative device is relatively simple. The plot is not divided into parts. There is little polyphony and few flashbacks. The emergence of literature making people aware of environmental issues, and more particularly of climate change, is an additional indication of an ongoing dynamic in representations in cultural imaginary. We might make a hypothesis that maybe we are going through a period of breakdown in the paradigms of environmental and intergenerational responsibility. It becomes necessary to develop an ethic of for the future in the sense of UNS. But on what should this ethic be based? On fear? On making people feel guilty? On making people accountable? On the love of the nature? The narrative we have examined fulfill the specific role of sounding the alarm. They make it possible to examine environmental questions in an original manner, but without answering them. They underline mankind's responsibility for climate change and support UNS ethical stance. Nature's vulnerability must be taken into account in all of our decisions, in all of our actions. It is an ethic of prospective responsibility, often anguished responsibility, because mankind's technical action concerns the future, the destiny of the planet, future generations who stare back at us from the future. Yet an excess of guilt-making discourses can create the opposite effect to that which is desired. To the rejection of said discourses and to the denial of human responsibility for climate change. The relative success of climate skeptical discourses can be explained, at least in part, by this phenomenon. An initial response to the call from philosophers and writers for ethical responsibility can be found maybe a little bit in sustainable development on the condition that the participation of citizens is real and sufficient. The young and the less young must be offered credible and just solutions which also take into account social and environmental inequalities. A new re-enchanting social imaginary must also be invented. But the novels we have just discussed provide no ready-made response to these complex questions. They encourage us to look at environmental issues in a new and stimulating way while we await the invention of new utopias. Thank you.